You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. My guest for episode 258 is singer-songwriter Dan Montgomery. After leading a short-lived project called Drugs Before Breakfast, he released his first solo album in 2004. You are currently listening to Always from that album, Man Out of State. He's just released his eighth album, Dispatches from the Desert, an entirely solo affair produced by his friend and one of my past guests, legendary Ben Vaughn. We'll be discussing Busted from that record, then looking to Beaumont from his previous record, 2023's Cast Iron Songs and Torch Ballads, then looking back to Favorite Color from Rosetta Please, A Love Story from 2006. We'll conclude by listening to Looking for a Fight, also from that new album. For more, see danmontgomery.bandcamp.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com or get the episodes ad-free at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. So I've played a little bit of Always from Man From Out of State, your first album, 2004. You had been good enough to send me your a whole decade before that, this Philadelphia band, Drugs Before Breakfast. We want to get pretty quickly to the new thing, but yeah, give us a little of the story from the beginning. And Dispatches from the Desert, this is your eighth album, is that right?
Correct, yes.
That's a lot of years for eight albums. Tell us a little about the journey before we hear.
Well, first of all, I want to go on record by saying, yes, I was in a band called Drugs Before Breakfast, but that's what happens when you allow the drummer to name the band. It was never my idea, but it got us a lot of notoriety, I will say that. I was a very late starter at everything because I was playing in cover bands in South Jersey when I was like 14 and I was like the youngest guy in the band. I stopped for a while because a lot of bad living got in the way. I had the strangest career trajectory in that I got off hard drugs because I went on the road with a band.
Get off drugs because you're on the road with a band. It's usually, yes, usually the other way around.
I know, exactly. My whole career is the exact opposite of what a plan would be. But I met a guy who you've actually interviewed, my friend Ben Vaughn. Mm-hmm. And we just met through a mutual friend in like 1985, I think it was. And he was looking for a sound man and I was looking for something to do. And I became his sound man. And for next 5 or 6 years, I was just on the road with him all the time. And we actually lived in the same house together. I hadn't done anything of my own musically until I retired from being his touring sound man. And I was in a couple little bands in Philadelphia. And then this band started called Drugs Before Breakfast, which was the first time I ever fronted a band. Mm-hmm. And in fact, until we did the recording that I sent you, I had never heard my voice on tape before. Because when I was 14, I tried singing in the first band I was in, and it didn't go well, and everyone made such fun of me, I just swore I would never sing again. Then I became a frontman in a band, and that became the band Drugs Before Breakfast. That we had a total of 2 gigs and 1 recording session, and then I had to move to Michigan for a couple of years. And then the band reunited after that, but it was never quite the same. And slowly but surely, I build up my solo career from there.
Okay. So yeah, it's about a decade later that we get Man From Out of State. And then it seems like you've been pretty consistent since then. Is this a part-time gig? Are you touring? Or usually I save these questions for later, but let's just get into it. Yeah.
I would like it to be a full-time gig. I am retired from my day job now. Mm-hmm. My wife had a stroke a few years back, so I've spent a lot of my time as a home healthcare person as well.
Geez.
So I don't tour as much, but it's also very hard to do that and not lose a ton of money these days. So I'm trying to find alternate versions of that from what I used to know.
We'll get to some highlights in the interim, but let's get right to the new thing. Dispatches from the Desert, which is entirely solo, but well, this is, you've explained now why Ben Vaughn is the producer. And there's the story on your press release here that these are all just you just playing your guitar by yourself, right? You could do this anywhere.
The idea originally was about 10 years ago, Ben did a record. He has a place out in the high desert in California. And he did a record there, just a solo acoustic record of like solo versions of songs from his catalog that he did inside an abandoned Airstream trailer on his property. And I've been saying for years, I want to do one of those too. And when we finally got around to it, we set up the studio in the Airstream trailer one morning. And about less than an hour later, a huge desert storm kicked up and it was just rocking the trailer left and right. And then it started filling up with sand. So we had to disassemble the studio and do it in his house.
Okay.
So it wasn't quite the original project we thought. And then originally it was going to be the same thing of me doing just kind of solo versions of songs from my catalog. But I kind of feel like that's the kind of thing you do when you're not writing. So I had a bunch of songs that were kind of, some were finished, some were half finished. So I went out there and every day I would just go out and finish a song and then we go in and record it. And yeah, it was just me, my guitar and my vocal, no overdubs, no punching in, no auto tune, no auto anything, no, not even any headphones.
Wow. Well, let's say a few words about Busted before we hear it in full.
Yeah, Busted was actually a song I wrote around the turn of the millennium, and I was playing in a band in Philly. It was a fairly well-received song, but somehow we never got a version of it I really liked. And, you know, when you're writing a lot, you tend to just, you know, older songs tend to fall in the back of the pile. But I always associate that song when I first wrote it. The first demo I did of it was out at Ben's place out in the desert back in about 2000. So I always associated that song with that area. So that was the first song we did for this project.
I rub my eyes, grit my teeth, and I shake my head in disbelief. And I've been up all night trying to write this song. But me and this guitar don't get along, and these strings just so old, the deep rusted, and I'm beaten, battered, broken and busted. There's a sign on the door that says we never close, and I smile to myself cause I know how that goes. There's a light in my baby's house that tells me she's home. Yeah, but those two silhouettes tell me she's not alone. And I just lost the only one I ever trusted. And I'm beaten, battered, broken and busted. Yeah, I'm beaten, battered, broken, busted. I walk these streets alone all night, and it don't feel no better for being right. And it don't feel no worse for being wrong. And it don't feel no good for knowing I brought all this on. Now I walk in these streets disgusted, and I'm beaten, battered, broken, busted. I'm beaten, battered, broken, busted. I'm beaten, battered, broken, and busted.
Tell me about that intro riff, right? That happens a million times because that could very easily get old, tedious, what, you know, that you're playing it so many times through the song, but it still feels fresh. Obviously, it's the intro to the record. Was that the origin of the song, or do you have lyrics in notebooks? Do you even recall at this point, given how old it is?
The riff was actually, when I first wrote it, it was a little more involved, which made it kind of hard for me to sing and stay on top of it, especially solo. So I kind of refined it down to what it is now. And luckily it works that way, because that was the big question was, does this, especially when there's nothing else adorning it, is this enough or is this too much? But that's when you go with your producer's opinions.
Well, it seems like through the individual lines in the verses, it's not like you're just singing the thing and then playing the riff, that sometimes the chords that you're playing ends in different places, right? It's going back to the tonic, or it is not doing the transition chord that's normally at the end of the riff. You're just going straight to the riff. Yeah. Any thoughts about, I mean, was this just because you played it for so many years, or was this literally like a really old one that was revived?
I'm going to be honest. I don't really know enough musically to know about the tonic and the this and the that. I'm just kind of play, and hopefully it sounds good.
Well, it's either that dun 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 dun. There's your transition chord, or sometimes you just don't do that. Dun 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 dun. You know, you're just staying on, and then you move on.
Yeah, part of that's probably more about just doing it solo like that than a thought out strategy, to be honest. Because it's not like you're going to throw three other guys off if you do it differently when you're playing it solo.
Sure. Obviously, you didn't use a click track, but it seems like it's pretty consistent throughout. Is it supposed to be? Because, you know, when you're by yourself, it seems like you can have these little stops as you do. You have your battered, you pause, let the note ring or something, but you're not like, okay, now we're doing the slow verse or something like that.
Oh, no, no. It's just how it came out. Mm-hmm. And there was no click track or anything involved. I'm not against using click tracks, but it was just not the way that project worked.
Well, so the fact that this is an older song, I guess that this makes sense to me that it jives with so much of your catalog, I guess because you went through that drug period, presumably we're sort of in touch with a whole culture of other people doing this kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So you have a lot of, you know, this crack house is a crack home. You have all these songs that are sort of using these, you know, which could sound like country tropes, but usually country is not so... You know, you wouldn't have Fino Barbie doll, right? Like that is, you're adding something from personal experience, from a humor, you know, an ironic distance to those years. Yeah, it was a little unclear, you know, because you start off, it seems like a really nice self-loathing song, right? I'm old, which you're writing this when you were not old, right? This is not a recent song.
You can feel pretty worn out at any age, especially if you've been through a lot.
Sure.
The one thing I will say, like, because references to certain things in drugs and drug life have come up a lot in my songs, and there's no point in hiding that. When I stopped doing all that stuff, and I've been not doing it for close to 35 years now or something like that, or when you're doing all that stuff and then you stop, people tend to talk about how they wasted so much time. And I understand that. But for me, because I can write these songs, it's kind of like, oh, that was all just a research project.
Yes, I have to like sum up angst that I felt over some woman when I was 19, but you have like a much richer variety of young person experiences to draw from.
That and two divorces, you know.
Okay, well, yeah, I mean, that's, you have adult stuff that you can throw in.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, I've been a mess my whole life. It's there's plenty to pick from.
You establish, you know, I feel so broken down and busted, but then you throw in the second verse, there's a cheating wife. Which you don't, it seems like you don't really need the cheating wife. Like the guy could just feel bad about himself anyway. And he thought about that sort of over-determining why he is sad.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you could have multiple crises going on at once.
Sure. And related, as you say, you know, I brought all this on.
Yeah, yeah. It was a cheating girlfriend, not a cheating wife, but at that time. But
sure, sure. To what extent is this like personal versus cool country tropes?
The second verse where he sees the two silhouettes and all, mm-hmm. that was based on a real experience.
Ah, okay.
The first verse, the last verse, is sort of like the mood surrounding me either before and after that moment happens, I guess. And also that realization that, yeah, somebody's kind of messing you up, but what did you do to cause that to happen?
Do you recall sort of how this one might have changed with Ben's feedback?
He's really good as an editor, where it's like, you know, you've already said this, you don't need to say this again. A thing I did not realize I did a lot in my writing was he's like, you know, you use a lot of joiners. I'm like, what do you mean? Because you sing a line and then there's a break musically and then you go and blah, blah, blah. He goes, you don't have to do that. He was like very much like as an editorial person as much as a producer. because there wasn't that much musically to produce, I guess.
Well, it's funny because this there's a lot of it in this song still. And it don't feel better, feel no better for being right. And it don't feel no better for being wrong. And it don't feel no good for no one. I brought this all on.
Yeah, I think being an older song, he let that go. But that was the example of us to, you know, to me to like keep an eye on that.
It did not result in a change in this particular case, but
not in that song. But it made me aware of that stuff for the other songs that were coming up.
I mean, I like it in this. I like the feel that it's sort of a long run-on sentence. You know, it's like you're listing your grievances.
A long run-off moment in his life right then.
Let me play around 217.
And it don't feel no good for knowing I brought all this on.
Just that pause there. I feel good knowing. Yeah, again, is that the kind of thing that might change from performance to performance?
Yes. Especially when there isn't a drummer to click behind you.
And you're doing these one song a day. How many takes does that mean?
I don't think there's anything we did more than three takes of. And most of it was just two.
Was it usually clear? What's the pattern? Like, okay, the first one, because I just recorded an album like this myself recently where I was playing live with two other guys and I don't think recorded, maybe a couple of them, we did more than that or we came back a different day and did it. But for the most part, it's like, okay, the first one is sort of, there's an obvious mistake in it somewhere. The second one is fine. The third one, just in case it's better, but usually it's the second one that ends up making the cut.
Yeah, usually, and that's been almost my entire recording career.
Okay.
Almost everything on my records are the second take. Even if we did six takes, it's almost always the second one.
With the third take, or if you go farther, or you, well, let me experiment a little. Let me make the pause longer. Let me cheese it up a little bit. Just, you know, take some sort of risk.
Yeah, that or just feeling like I didn't know if I put it across emotionally or anything like that, you know, enough. But generally speaking, almost everything is the second take. Because it's usually like, oh, that's cool, do another one. And usually almost always was the second take. I think there's only one. There's a song called My Own Business. I think there's three takes we did on that one.
What was the thing from your press release that you and Ben, you know, direct communication? Is that?
Like I said, I would work on a song in the morning and then I would bring it in and I'd play it for Ben. And he'd already heard like earlier versions of some of these songs. And then we would just kind of go over the lyrics and or the music and just, like I said, he was very good at editing things. Like, you know, like you don't, there's not going to be a solo there, so let's not worry about that. Like I said, it just became about direct communication. Anything else is superfluous. If it's getting in the way of the storyline getting across, that it's just not necessary.
Let me play just the very end.
I'm beaten, battered, broken and busted.
So we're going to do a little broken and busted. We're going to do a little bit of change,
yeah.
But it's never going to, you know, enter a different realm. Like this is just very a moment, a slice of life. It can't have a bridge that goes anywhere substantially.
Yeah. And a lot of my songwriting, especially the stuff on that record, because it's a solo thing and it's very almost like short story, like songs that it's very much, a lot of them are a moment in time. That's typical of a lot of my songwriting now.
Well, let's get a slightly different one out there. Beaumont, from your last album before this, Cast Iron Songs and Torch Ballads.
Yes.
2023. A whole band.
Oh, yeah.
A different kind of storytelling. Yeah, can you say a few words about it before we hear it?
Yeah, Beaumont, I really liked. It came out really great. Story-wise, it's pretty much exactly what it's saying. Like, I think everybody has a friend or two they know that calls them up when they're in trouble and they either need a ride or money or both or something even more extreme. And it was just one of those moments. A friend of mine called me and she needed money. She had to get out of town fast. I felt it was probably best not to even ask why. And you hope, you know, if you end up in that some similar position, that friend would help do the same thing for you. Now, I will say that the friend, when she called me and explained her situation, she was actually going to San Antonio, but that sounds like too much of a happy dance hall town.
So sure.
I changed it to Beaumont, where George Jones is from, so you can't get sadder than that.
We'll be right back.
ship shape. The more that he kept drinking, the more that she kept thinking about making her escape. 'Cause once he flipped out, she started to slip out. And after he shipped out, well, she just skipped town. She told me, I gotta get to Beaumont tonight. Can you help me, friend? If I can get to Beaumont, I can set things right.
you've got a full band here. Was this a full band put together for the recording by the producer? Were these people you were playing live with?
Oh, that's my band here in Memphis. We've done 3 or 4 records that way. And the other guitar player is my co-producer, a guy named Robert Mache, who used to be in that band, the Continental Drifters, if you're familiar with them. Mm-hmm. And he was also in the Steve Wynn band when he first went solo from the Dream Syndicate. And Robert was one of my favorite guitar. I was a huge Steve Wynn fan. Robert was one of my favorite guitar players I ever saw. And his wife's originally from here in Memphis. And they were living in New Orleans. They washed up in Memphis after Katrina. And I just introduced myself and we started playing together. And it's just been just a magical combination ever since. But yeah, that record is my full Memphis road band. Although on that song, and I'm still not sure how it happened to this day, somehow I ended up being the lead guitar player on that song. I don't know how that happened.
Well, the main riff sounds recognizably, you know, like the riff from the first song in terms of except you're playing with a thick distortion, which is way harder to put across something with that much movement in it, such that, you know, some of the time when you go into it, it seems like, wait, is this a guitar solo? No, it's just the riff. But, you know, there's a lot of movement. So you're doing like acoustic technique on your electric.
I thought all along that I was laying this thing down and that Robert would be playing some blazing lead thing over it or something. And he's just like, no, you got it. And I was like, what?
Okay, so he's just doing the little acoustic strumming then, or is that also you?
Yeah, he did that and he did the string patch stuff on the keys. But yeah, I'm doing most of the acoustic guitar. Most of the guitars are out of me. He's mostly doing the key stuff on that and some percussion stuff. Myself, him, our bass player, Tom Arndt, and Robert's wife, Candace Mache, who also sings with us, they're all doing those huge background vocals on it, too.
Would you play live with this lineup, or would it be just you and Robert?
I mean, my favorite way is to do it with the full band. Mm-hmm. I've done it solo. I've done it duo. I did it at a gig out. I did a couple gigs out in California when that record came out that I couldn't afford to take the band out there because it wasn't full tour kind of thing, and had a pickup band in California for the couple gigs I did. We did that version there. It always seems to go over really well. And it's funny, I never thought about it till you just mentioned it, but like, yeah, you can kind of hear a through line between Busted and that song in my guitar playing. It's just like you said, one's through a fuzz box and one is not.
I thought I heard, maybe I was hallucinating it, that when you're doing the progression in the intro, the third chord is different than when you're actually singing over it.
Yes, it is.
Okay, all right. So I'm not...
The third chord in the intro and the chorus is an E minor, but in the verses, it's a C.
Okay, so was that just easier to sing over, or what? Do you recall why that happened?
I just thought it would be more interesting to not do the same thing the whole time.
Sure.
And again, a lot of these songs, like I said, when they start out, it's just me by myself, so you don't really know if it works with just me and a vocal and an acoustic guitar, or me and a vocal and a piano. Then it will work with other musicians as long as they're good musicians and they're listening. So it kind of starts in the same place in that way as say, Busted did.
Are you a Neil Young fan?
Big Neil Young fan. I will say I haven't kept up with him over the last 15 years or so, but a big Neil Young fan. And that was actually my downfall when I tried to sing when in my first band I mentioned earlier, I tried to sing a Neil Young song, but my voice just does not work with a Neil Young song.
Were you at least just doing it an octave lower? When I do a Neil Young song, I just don't try to sing it in his range because it's...
Well, no, because I was 14. My voice hadn't even really changed.
Ah, okay. So you could do that. And yeah, that's a good way.
I couldn't sell it, but I could hit it, I guess, is what it came down to.
Neil Young can sing with a little tiny falsetto and he's cool, but
yeah,
a 14-year-old, maybe not so much. So you really give this one room to breathe, right? This could have been a 3.5-minute song at least. But the reason I brought up Neil Young is because it seems like, right, if he were doing it, then this is exactly the kind of fuzz guitar tone that he might use, right, even back in the 70s. But then it would, you know, dissolve into some sort of solo, whereas I guess you're saying that Robert was kind of filling that role a little bit with the analog string synth to fill in that space. That, because in fact, the first time that came in, I'm like, wait, is that a distorted sustained guitar? Like, it sounds like he kind of sort of put it through a guitar pedal or something.
Oh, I'm sure he probably did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cause that song's like 6 minutes long, I think, or even longer. And it was funny when we were done recording it, I said to Robert, I said, you know, well, maybe you could chop some down. And he came back to me there. He goes, it all belongs there. I'm not going to touch it. And I am not afraid of a long song myself.
And it says something about the quality of the chorus, which is so immediate, right? It's just one line, really. I mean, with yeah, that you're responding to then. Yeah. Any thought about the vocal arrangement on that, that you're going to, we're going to extend it out by like, well, let's let them do it by themselves. Or was that a mixing thing? Like take your voice out just to see what they sound like.
Basically. Yeah. That's kind of how it happened. It was like, my voice was there throughout the whole thing. And then we took it out and saw like, oh, that actually brings out more in a way. And they just really went to town with the vocal blend on it.
But it sounds like they don't really like lift them up in the mix to sort of compensate and take over the lead. It's just
No. That's a decision that we made. You know, mm-hmm. It was going to be this. It's not going to do what you expected to do, I guess.
And then you got a fade on this, and it seems like the band kicks into high gear just as it's fading.
Yes,
like the drums start playing double time and.
It got a little wild after that, yes.
Oh, so was there an embarrassing part that was sort of after?
Oh, no. Okay. It just had gone on long enough at that point is all.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what the actual end was? Did you just stop at some point? Like, we're going to fade this. Or was there a big, you know, trash can ending or something like that?
There was a big ending, but I think we always knew it was probably going to be a fade. It was one of those kind of songs.
But I guess, right, if you're playing it live, like, that's not...
It's funny, me and Ben have butted heads on this over the years. Like, when a song's really cooking, I like a fade in a way. Like, Are you familiar with Marquee Moon by Television?
Sure, of course.
When they reissued that on CD, you know, when the title song, when it gets to the end and it starts over again and it fades, as the riff starts up again, the vocal starts. When they reissued on the CD, you find out they only sing one more line and then it just all ends. Whereas for 25 years, I assumed that song went on for another 10 minutes in the studio. And I was really bummed to hear it end.
Let me play a little of the bridge here. This is 3 minutes in. So just that you got these like little bell sounds, but again, they're pretty subtle. Like, what is the proper volume to listen to this at?
I would say loud, but that's just...
Really loud. Okay, so the bells are not actually quiet. You don't have the rest of it loud enough if you can't hear the bells well enough. There's a lot of 90s stuff, I feel, specifically, where you should just crank it until, you know, Smashing Pumpkins or whatnot, or Sugar, right? Crank it so the vocal sounds like it's supposed to, like a normal, somebody's in the room with you singing, and then everything else will be mind-bogglingly louder than that. And that's the way it's supposed to be.
The CD wars did not help that anywhere. Everything just went into the red and all. You can have a very rocking, loud, abrasive song and still have some dynamics to it.
I guess Neil Young has never followed that 90s mixing rule, right? You always hear a lot of him, even if he's singing a little tiny high voice, even with his, you know, big sludgy guitar. So it's really just a matter of use something else to set the volume, the drums.
Yeah, and the only time Neil Young really went with anything trend-wise was in the 80s, and some of that didn't go as well as it could have.
Sure. We haven't really talked about the lyrics of this one, right? The first song is A Slice of Life. You mentioned this as still sort of being a one-time occurrence in your real life, but it's sort of written out like, well, she does this. Like, I don't even ask her anymore, as if this has happened.
For the person this was involving, to find out too much is to become complicit. Uh-huh. So it's, you know, you accept these people in your life because they accepted you when you weren't necessarily doing well, maybe, and you do what you can to help them along. But sometimes, like I said, it's best just not to know. You have a plausible deniability.
Again, there's kind of a overdetermination of her motivations, which is, you know, this is like real life, but as if this is somebody that's trying to escape. And maybe this is why I keep thinking of this as something that might happen again and again, you know, when you're in a crappy, abusive relationship and into a trailer with a drunken sailor. That is that's a funny little rhyme.
First, it was like it was too easy. But then I added the line, but she couldn't keep things ship shape. And I thought, oh, we can use this.
Okay. Wanting to escape from something like that seems enough of motivation. But then, well, no, actually, it's probably that she's just as messed up as he is. And probably he's going to score. So this, you know, sounds again like your experience in adjacent to the drug world.
Yes. If you've been one of those people, you can't really be too judgmental about other people. Well, you can be or you cannot be. It's one or the other, but you know, it's kind of a there go, you know, for the grace of God go I kind of thing.
Well, we didn't talk about it in the first song. There's a sign on the door that says we never close. I smile to myself because I know how that goes, which, I mean, I don't have the requisite experience to say that I know how that goes. What is that like? Because places like that are where alcoholics go just to be able to drink 24 hours.
When I was living that life, my big thing was meth. So I never closed.
Okay.
I would be awake for at least 3 days to a week at a time.
Sure.
So I just remember one time seeing a sign that said, we never close. I went, yeah, no, that feels.
This song does not seem to have and all over the place. You do have, well, because once he flipped out, she started, and after he shipped out, it's moderate. There's still some ands in there.
I'm a work in progress, man.
And you can't make her. It just makes things hang together. Like some dumb caper hanging bad paper. I guess I don't know what the hanging bad paper.
In criminal terms, a paper hanger is somebody who passes bad checks.
Okay. All right. I was picturing actual counterfeiting or something, which seems too enterprising. But a bad check.
Basically the same thing, yes.
And you can't make her see what's at stake for her, which if it was just like she was escaping a bad relationship. Well, like, yeah, that's what's at stake, is getting out of the bad relationship. There's no,
yeah,
that would be the positive thing, that the bad thing is not going to Beaumont. It's not staying in Beaumont.
Could be a man, could be to score. It's like, what are you going there for? You know, something positive or just something else?
Right. So then we get to the bridge that, you know, that I already played. And I was wondering if she made it this time, was she finally free? Right. Okay. So this is sort of a recurring situation, but no, she's now calling you collect.
Yeah.
It is hard to help somebody that is continually in distress. I do know that from personal experience.
Yes. Yes. I've been that person too. So I have to look at it from two angles sometimes.
And is the repeated chorus at the end, is that sort of, at least well expresses the kind of repetitive nature of the situation, but was that intentional or just, this is a nice sort of danceable chorus, let's just keep it going?
Originally it was just, this is a great chorus, let's keep it going. When examining it afterwards, it was like, conceptually, yes, that is part of it. You know, it's something that just keeps going, you know, because that's how life is.
Let's get the third song out there. Favorite Color from Rosetta Please, A Love Story, 2006. So an early album, straightforward, on par with the first song, but with a different band setup here, more country with steel guitar and violin. Yeah, do you want to say a little about it before we hear it?
Sure. Yeah, that was from my second album called Rosetta Please, A Love Story, which was my first attempt at a concept album. That song itself has a very interesting kind of funny birth in that it's the only song I've ever written on stage in mid-performance.
Okay.
The first year I was living here in Memphis, I moved here, it was just 24 years ago, just about a week, 2 weeks ago. I was playing every Tuesday night at a bar called Murphy's, and nobody knew who I was. Nobody was coming to see me because nobody knew who I was, but my name would be in the paper every week, so it gave the impression I was doing something. But so most of that year when I played there, it was mostly I was playing to myself, the bartender, and a crack whore who was always there. Out of really nobody paying attention, I had came up with this picking pattern, and I was just playing solo that night, and I just kind of free associated the song, I'd say 90% of it as we hear it now. The bartender and the crack whore really liked it, and the crack whore just kept asking for it over and over again. She'd come back every week, ask for it, so I was like, there's something to this song, you know? Then one day she wasn't there. One Tuesday she wasn't there anymore, and I really missed that crack whore. But it reminded me of a story that happened to me in real life back in New Jersey in the early 80s with somebody I met in a bar. I walked in this bar I used to go into all the time, and it was a pretty sleazy bar. And this guy I'd never met before asked me, he goes, if you listen to my story, I'll buy you drinks. And I thought, sure, how bad could it be? And it turned out he was sitting in a bar waiting for his girlfriend to come back and pay for his bar tab while she was out working the streets to pay his bar tab. And I assumed it was just crazy drunk talk. And right around 1 a.m. when the lights came on for last call, this woman appeared in the doorway with a guy, left a guy in the doorway, walked over to where we were sitting, laid a bunch of money down on the table or on the bar, and then just walked out with the guy, and the guy sitting next to me just kind of muttered under his breath, Rosetta, please. And it just, all that, I've forgotten all about that for years, and then it just, I wrote the whole record kind of around that.
Well, let's play it.
Baby, baby, where you gone tonight? Baby, baby, where you gone tonight? You know what you're doing, just ain't right. Baby, baby, when you coming home? Baby, baby, are you coming home? You know I'll be here all alone. Did you know my favorite color's blue? Did you know my favorite color's blue? It's been that way since I met you. Baby, baby, are you gone downtown? Baby, baby, are you gone downtown? I can see by that dress just where you're bound. Baby's gone to meet a sugar man. Baby's gone to meet a sugar man. She get that money any way she can. Did you know my favorite color's blue? Did you know my favorite color's blue? It's been that way since I met you. Come home, all set and high. Baby, come home, all set and high. And I know better than to ask her why. Did you know my favorite color's blue? Now my favorite color's blue. It's been that way since I met you. It's been that way since I met you.
I guess, you know, if you're playing that slow, then that leaves you open to make up lyrics.
Well, and also it's like, you know, it's got a folk blues kind of structure. So you're repeating the first line three times and just got something to rhyme it on the last one, which is when nobody's paying attention to you on stage, it's pretty easy to do. That was the first band I had in Memphis that was on that record. So it's a very different feel than the band is on Beaumont, say.
So I will admit that the first time you were pitched to me by Howard, I think after the 2023 album. I'm sure I listened to a little bit and it just, okay, this is a sort of more in the country rock area. I have had a number of people like that. And it wasn't until this time when he's like, you know, you gotta try this guy, that I really appreciated how good you are at using tropes like this, right? Where blues, right? Oh, baby, you make me blue. You got literally have baby, but yet it can still feel really direct and honest, right? This communication thing that you're talking about. And part of it is clearly because you're working off of personal experience, or you're tweaking the cliches a little bit. So they're not actually cliches anymore. Although, I don't know. What do you think of Baby's Gone to Meet Her Sugar Man? It doesn't seem like you would write that now. That line.
I probably wouldn't, but I wish I had.
Okay, all right.
And here's why. For whatever reason, that song has always seemed to connect with people.
Uh-huh.
And that is a line that a lot of people mention it, they really like.
Well, and she get that money any way she can, you know, so it's not she gets, it's she get, you know, that you're using what... How much firsthand blues have you spent time listening to? Like, was that a part of your formative influences?
I mean, yeah. I mean, like I grew up right outside of in New Jersey, right outside of Philadelphia. So when I was 14, I would go see Johnny Winter, say. But the opening act was Muddy Waters or James Cotton. You know, people I didn't know, but I got to learn about. So that's always been part of my language. I've never wanted to be one of those blues guys in a fedora, say.
Sure. Yeah, but just having the real, right, that most of my blues stuff is through Rolling Stones' Silly Blues song, in terms of what I was listening to as a teenager.
Well, sure.
You know, not actual firsthand black people singing. Like
I didn't spend $5 to go see Muddy Waters. I just happened to see him open, and it was like, wow, this is the real deal, you know. I mean, that was a good thing about where I grew up, too. Radio was very open to you know, a lot of things in Philadelphia. Concert bills were very varied. It was really great then, in that sense.
Any thought about your vocal delivery on this, right? Because it's, you know, you got some kind of legato, some cone and cone. There's some real singing on this, even though this is very early in your career. Well, I guess 2006, you'd been doing it for 13 plus years. So it's not that early.
That was only my second album. So to everybody else, I was brand new. And not many people heard my first record. So for most people, that's the first time they heard me. It took me a long time to be able to be satisfied with my listening to myself sing back. But I don't think that's an unusual experience for a lot of people. Now, that song, I will say, on that recording, it's in the key of F, and now I do it in D. So just over the years, things between aging and just changing things up and find, like, we're working on a new full band record right now with my Memphis band. And for the first time in my life, I'm actually kind of happy with my singing.
The recording is higher than you do it now, that you do down to D. Okay.
Yeah.
Johnny Cash is a pretty good model in terms of, like, there's a little bit of crooning on it, but it's also very talk sung in a certain way, such that you can't really be out of tune if you're Johnny Cash.
Yes, exactly.
Right? How much are you actually aiming at a note?
Yeah.
But some of this, you know, it seems a little more risky, or, you know, on the crooning side of the Cash. Any favorite vocalists that you, or is it just like, this is, what can I get to come out of my face?
For years, I get done doing a vocal, and like, if Robert Mshay was my producer, he'd say, oh, that's good. That's the take. And I'd listen back and I'd say, I don't know. He goes, what's the problem? I said, I thought I would sound more like Waylon Jennings.
Sure.
But like, because like, to me, that's an ideal voice. It's masculine, but it's sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
When we did this Dispatches from the Desert record, that's actually the first Johnny Cash American Recordings thing was an obvious example of what we were trying to go for, where it's just solo guitar and vocal. And that is a record that is definitely about direct communication.
So this band, this is not a band like the steel player and the violin player on from Rosetta Please, right? Are these the producer's friends? Are these people that you had?
No, that was the band I had at the time.
Oh, okay.
We had a drummer named Jason Hatcher. The steel is a lap steel player named Mike Veazey. And the bass player, who was actually the first member of the band, who was only 16 at the time, was a young woman named Maggie Veazey, who was kind of just learning to play bass and the only one interested in playing with me at that time. So she started playing with me when I did those Tuesday night gigs. And then her father very wisely went, why is my 16-year-old daughter playing with some guy I've never heard of in a really dicey bar till 3 in the morning every Tuesday? So he started showing up. So, and he was a really good player, but kind of like too flashy for me. And he mentioned one day, he said, I really want to play with you guys. But he was like very like, you know, knew every blues lick, you know, kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And one day he mentioned, I just bought a lap steel, but I don't really know how to play it. I was like, bring that next week. And so he was kind of had to, like, he was behind his learning curve. So it kept him from getting out over top of things. And then when he got really good at that, I convinced him to get a baritone guitar.
Ah.
Because same thing, you have to be thinking instead of just playing.
Sure.
And then when he got good at that, I got him to get a mandolin. And then he was allowed to play his Les Paul finally, because he understood the concept by then.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's something to be said about, like, I was noticing how with this bass, how just minimalist and how well it matches. So it sounds like you just have an extra string in this song.
That's exactly how it was. Maggie was not trained at all and just the sweetest kid and really wanted to be play with me. So we figured out a way to make it work.
In Beaumont, the bass is pretty minimalist through a lot of it, but then I think it's the bridge where the bass kind of freaks out a little bit. Your sort of, how much are you ordering around your musicians?
Generally, especially the band I have now, they're all really good players. They're all really good listeners. So generally, I let everybody have pretty much free reign unless I hear something I really don't like.
Until it's too much, right? Because they're so tasteful. Right, violin is the one thing, like, you can't have a beginner violin player.
No, God, no.
Camper Van Beethoven being a notable exception. That was my first interview for this podcast, was one of the, had talked to Jonathan, the violin player from, you know, and he was another guy who was, like, he was a guitarist, but they wanted a violin in the band. So, like, okay, well, I do also play violin, but it sort of sounds, especially on the early stuff, like the really classic stuff, like, you know, your middle school player, you know, that he's just playing.
No, but we had a very good violin player for the recordings, that's for sure.
Yes. So there's something charming either way, but the fact that you're combining that, and you can't tell on the steel that he's a new player. He just sounds tasteful.
Oh, no, no. He sounds great on that day. And it was the funniest recording session because we did it at this guy who now is very well known as a producer here in Memphis, a guy named Scott Bomar. He did the Hustle and Flow soundtrack and that Song Kong Blue movie just came out. But we did this at his house. He didn't have a studio yet. And literally all the lap steel parts, Mike was playing the lap steel in the kitchen through my Fender, my 60s Fender Champ amp, which was put into the oven for reverb.
Okay.
It was just placed in the oven for some kind of ambient sound, and it sounds great.
That sounds like Ben Vaughn level of trickery.
I live with a man who recorded the whole album in his car.
Yes, so, that's exactly what I had in mind.
This seems very, very modest by comparison.
We got harmonies on this one, but it's more one person who's just has a very Emmylou Harris sort of vibe.
Yes, that was a woman named Kim Richardson, who's no longer in Memphis, but she was a really great singer. I just knew her from around the scene in Memphis, and that record, most of the harmonies are just me and a female singer because it's kind of a conversation between a man and a woman, that record.
Sure.
So it didn't really call for any big, vast harmonies or anything like that.
Although it's an interesting conversation that, right, unlike the other song, you didn't, like, trade off, right? Either she's with you or you're by yourself.
Yeah.
But there's never just, you know, her. So how is it a conversation?
Well, maybe it's a dialogue, I guess.
Well, I do like the effect of, like, okay, is she going to come in just for one line? Is she going to come in for two lines? That it's never that, okay, now we've reached the part where she's just going to be there, or maybe we have to add a third because it has to keep growing in some way. Like, you know, it's very restrained.
Yeah, some of it's decoration and some of it's advancing the storyline.
Let me play from the instrumental verse. Just that, okay, finally the drums have opened up. They're kind of rolling. And what is there a particular country? 1, 2, 3, snare. 1, 2, like, is there a name for that?
I would be the last to know.
I've certainly heard it, you know, but as opposed to one snare, you know, that kind of thing.
Oh, I'm sure in Nashville there's a term for it.
Sure. But that, yeah, but that he's kind of filling the rest of the space by, you know, it shows him he's, you know, actually a really good drummer. And this is the first place in the song where both the steel and the violin get to be there at the same time.
Yes.
That every other place, it was like, is this a violin verse? Or, okay, now this is the steel chorus, or, you know, going back and forth.
Well, the other thing you got to figure in, too, is that, like I said, this is only my second album, and I'm producing it, and I don't really know a lot yet. Mm-hmm. So some of it may not be as intentional as you think.
Right. There is some growth in this. It is not like the first song where we're going to, you know, you're just by yourself and it's just going to be in the moment. And it's not like the second song where, okay, well, you had the intro that you play by yourself, but then the whole band comes in and, okay, we got the vocals coming in for the chorus and we have the bells and things on the bridge. And we have, so there's definitely growth throughout, but, you know, with something that is this straightforward as where you're going tonight and this slow, like it's like each verse has to be a new little adventure. So like this is the one where the violin is really going to sing on it, and then that's going to be gone next time, that kind of thing.
Yeah, because the violin was added later, so that wasn't in the band session. So it may have just been where we could fit it in around what the steel did.
That's interesting. It seemed more coordinated than that.
But no, it wasn't. Hopefully as I've gone on with recording, we've gotten more planned out and more sure about what I'm doing, you know.
So the violin is filling the holes that the steel did not see fit to fill, as opposed to like just insisting on playing throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, and or saying, you know, I'll do this lick, you do that, you do that spot. It was just, we did this thing, and then we added the violin afterwards. I don't think there's any keys on that song. Same thing with that record, we added the keys later. We didn't have a keyboard player at the time or anything. But I don't think there's any on that song, if I recall.
Let me play the very end.
I met you
Yeah, it's always funny when an overdub becomes like the thing that stands out, right? It is the you thought you had an ending, but wait, here's a way better ending.
Yeah. It's beautiful when that happens.
Uh-huh.
I mean, one of the great things about recording is the happy accidents.
So as far as the, my favorite color is blue. I mean, that sounds like you're a masochist. Did you, since I met you, you make me blue all the time, but you're my favorite, you know, I still love you. But yeah.
Well, again, this is a story about a guy who's just out of jail. He's trying to keep his stuff together and his girlfriend is paying for everything by being a prostitute. So it's a conflicted life.
Yeah, because it doesn't sound at the beginning. It sounds more like the first song, when you're coming home, I'll just be all alone. Like, why are you out there cheating on me, babe? Kind of. But now you're adding this whole much more depraved subtext here.
Well, yeah. And then the last verse is like, baby, come home so sad and high. And I know better than to ask her why. And that's kind of the crux of the whole story right there. You know, but you don't want to hear about it.
Okay, but he's not her pimp in the story or something.
He's not that together.
I'm just going with the flow here. That's the the flow right down the drain. Okay.
Exactly, yes. But they're going down together. That's the important thing.
Given how sort of messed up these people are, this could be way more angsty or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
But it's going to be a nice little lullaby, pretty much.
I mean, I tend to write about some very dark things, but it's not my goal, is not to bum people out, you know? Yeah, it's dark, but it could be darker.
Or, you know, this kind of reminded me of 13 by Big Star.
Oh, wow.
Just in terms of it having a very straightforward, slow presentation that sort of repeats a thing. You know, obviously this is more steeped in the blues genre, but anything Big Star does is like, has this underlying angst, and often even just vocally it's singing in a sort of extreme way.
Oh yeah. Especially if you get to that third Big Star record.
yes exactly, that makes it sound like the person is actively on heroin while the recording.
I wonder why that would be.
I mean, yeah. I guess that's we didn't get to hear what you would have recorded in 1987 or whatever, when you were in
I would never show. I wouldn't have even showed up to the studio, I'm sure. I'm sure I would have got sidetracked somewhere.
Are there super angsty recordings somewhere? And oh, no, you said you hadn't even sung on
recording
before.
No, because I was afraid to commit anything. Yeah.
All right.
Now, my past is my own past.
Any cassette tapes of your high school cover band that you pull out?
Not that I am. Somebody somewhere once had a tape of a rehearsal we did, but I never, nobody could ever find it again. Years later, I was asking around about it. But we were a cover band. So, you know, it was like, although I have to say, like, I get in this argument with people a lot because people are very dismissive about people being in cover bands. And I think especially early on in your, if you're going to be a songwriter, spend 2 years in a cover band because you're going to have to learn songs you wouldn't choose to learn. And that will give you an insight into certain things as later on when you are writing your own songs going, you know, that bridge from that Beatles song, something like that might work here, you know. Almost like they used to say, yeah, you do 2 years of service for your country. You should do 2 years of service in a cover band for your songwriting.
Well, and yeah, specifically like as a guitarist, like if you learn Blackbird, you know, oh, that's a thing I can do. I can slide up and down the neck. And now I'll write songs like that.
If you're not forced to, you'll probably never learn it. All my songwriting started out of since I was a teenager was I was trying to learn a song. Like if I'm trying to learn, say, whatever song, and I'm like, it's not right, but it's not bad. And I would just write a song from there. It's just, my incompetence was my inspiration.
I did not have a lot of cover band experience. I mean, I did, you know, a gig in high school where we had to work up a bunch of stuff for the gym jam. The equivalent of that was I was in a church choir as a young person. So I learned how to harmonize and, like, you know, having to do all these weird Christmas songs and religious songs, and I wouldn't know how to do harmonies.
I got kicked out of Catholic school very young, so I didn't get to I was in Glee Club, but they never really taught us harmony, so
there you go. Glee Club, that works. Well, it's been a pleasure. We're just going to introduce the last thing, which is we want to get people back looking at Dispatches from the Desert again. About half the album is out now, right?
Yeah, so this will come out in August, I guess, so probably 8 songs by then.
Okay.
And there's 12 songs altogether. There's one song every month on the last Friday of each month on Bandcamp.
And you had picked Looking for a Fight. Is that one out yet?
That might be next month or the month after, probably.
All right. Well, I'm going to say it's a world premiere.
Yes.
Looking for a Fight, a much more bouncy story song, still with a lot of nice self-loathing in it.
Yeah.
Sort of sounds like a closing tune for the album. It's not for the album, but it's at least for this interview. Yeah, do you want to say a few words about it before we say goodbye?
Yeah, Looking for a Fight was mostly came from a dream, and I very rarely remember dreams, and this might be a good example of why. You ever one of those dreams where you're running and you can't get to something on time or something like that? It's kind of like that. I fight with myself, and I'm going to lose. And then there's a couple lines in there, I don't have to win, but I just have to fight. That was based around my brother when he was in college. We would go out to bars and he would get really drunk. And my brother's very athletic, but he's shorter than me. And he would find the biggest guy in the bar after he had a couple shots and just start poking him, literally. And just like to fight. And he's not that way anymore, I have to say. He's a great guy to be around now.
So this is a much more recent composition, right? Is this from the past?
Yeah, this was written during that desert stay, yes.
Okay, so I had that clearly in mind, maybe we would have talked about it in more detail at the beginning and put the other one at the end, but Busted sounds like it should be a solo song. Like, it sounds like it is made for that project. This one, again, it's the restraint. It sort of is begging for some violin or something like that.
Oh, yeah, you could go to town on that one as far as, you know, fleshing it out, and maybe someday I'll redo it in a produced version. But, you know, again, it was just the direct communication thing. It was just like that was a song where I originally had a solo and stuff in it, and Ben was like, take it out. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's just delaying the story.
Yes, I actually even thought about this with the album that has been in mixing hell for months and months for me now, that like I had these songs, I could just play them, but maybe I should release them as a solo album first, you know, just guitar, and then do a fully arranged, overproduced version. And, you know, that just ended up being too much trouble. So I did something in between, which is still not done. But yeah, there's something definitely appealing about, no, we're going to be purists. It's just going to be solo, and that's just what the project is.
And also coming after the last couple of records I've done, which were much bigger full band records, and for the first time on my records, I started playing electric guitar again about 5-6 years ago. I was always just a guy playing acoustic guitar when I because that's when I came to town, that's all I was. Mm-hmm. It was just nice to shake things up. The last record was much more of a full, more rocking record. So it was just, let's shake it up and do something completely different. And the record I'm working on now sounds completely different than Dispatches from the Desert. And I don't think my records are big radical changes from each other, but I think there's a definite growth through the whole thing.
Yes, that's a good final question. Yeah, tell us a little more about the thing that you're working on right now, what its stage is at.
The full band tracks are done. There's like 14 songs. So we're at that stage of, are we going to edit it down or are we going to make a double record? But I don't even know if anybody buys records, let alone double records. So that's a problem down the line. So we're at the point now where the songs are done, the basic recordings of it, just adding some percussion and background vocals and stuff now. We have a great keyboard player we use on sessions, a guy named Rick Steff here in Memphis, who plays in that band Lucero, if you're familiar with them. He's just an amazing player. Usually he just comes in, because he's always on the road, he just comes in and adds some stuff when we're done. But this time we got to do for a third of the album, record it with him as a band member. And that really opened things up in a very different way too. So this is a very different record. Right now, I think the working title is Pictures from the Gone World, which is a name of a Lawrence Ferlinghetti book I really like, a poetry book. I tend to not end up keeping the working titles, but this will be a very, very different record. And like I said, for the first time, I'm actually really satisfied with my vocals even. And it's funny, interesting, about a year ago, I started learning to do some home recording. I'd always avoided that. And so for this record, basically the stuff that wasn't recorded live, I did all my vocals here at home, and it was much more relaxing for me because you don't like have somebody through the glass wincing when you hit that wrong note that you already know is wrong. So we've hit on a really, really nice balance with this new record. So hopefully that'll be out sometime in 2027.
Well, looking forward to hearing that. Sounds like it was good for you to go through this trial by trailer to yes, you know, really purify what you do before sort of opening it back up to collaboration and the full band.
Trial by sand.
All right, here it is, Looking for a Fight. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Mark.
I went looking for a fight when I looked into the mirror that night. Didn't like the man I saw, and that man, he didn't like me at all. He said, I'm giving you a warning, and I'm making it quite clear by tomorrow morning of us should not be here. So I went looking for a bed where I could rest my weary head. Found a pillow made of stone. I lie there sulking all alone. I know it weren't a drinking I left that long ago. All the way I'm thinking, it's got me feeling mean and low. So I tossed and turned all night, afraid to face the morning light. Didn't know just who I'd see, who'd be looking back at me. I'll square off with any man if I think I'm right. I don't gotta win, I just gotta fight. So I walked on down the hall, see my doppelganger there on the wall. Held my breath and burst right in, ready to face my evil twin. Couldn't be more clearer, and it couldn't be less fair. As I looked in the mirror, there was nobody there. I went looking for a fight. I looked into the mirror that night.
Love that tune. Thanks so much to Dan. Again, he is continuing to release the new songs on his Bandcamp page. That's danmontgomery.bandcamp.com. And if you're looking around for him on the streaming services, there are multiple musicians named Dan Montgomery. You know, you can just look up Cast Iron Songs and Torch Ballads or Rosetta Please, some of the album names of things we covered here. Since I mentioned my ongoing album toward the end of this interview, I'll just give you the update, which is I haven't really done anything on it for months. So I will be starting to teach a new class this fall and have even less time. So I pissed away most of the summer that I should have been working on the mixes. It'll come out sometime, hopefully before the end of the year. If you are interested in hearing more of my tunes, that's marklint.bandcamp.com. But I'm sure you're more interested in this podcast, whose home is nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Or get your ad-free experience at patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Making a small donation there will let me know that you want this podcast to continue. My main podcast, The Partially Examined Life, does very well with its level of support, but maybe because people are already giving money through that, it's a little harder for me to get funds for these other podcasts, especially since I don't have a lot of time to create bonus content. However, for each of these episodes, I do exhaustive notes laying out the lyrics and the structure of the songs, and I put those on my Patreon page. Again, that's patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I think looking at those while you listen will make your experience more enjoyable, but what do I know? However you are subscribed to this, you will want to hear my next episode with Glenn Morrow, an old hand from the Hoboken punk scene, who became the founder and president of Bar None Records and has new albums as a much older person. And then a few days from now, I will be recording an episode with Jackie Hunt, who is the singer in Single Gun Theory and has a nice solo album out that sounds a lot like Kate Bush or Tori Amos. So come back for that. Hope you're doing well. There's still some summer left for you and me to do musical activities in. Take advantage of it. And if you were interested in that philosophy class I mentioned, maybe you could take it from me. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/class. Enrollment is happening right now. In any case, keep on musicking. Till next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off. Looking for home.